This is episode 102 of Social Entrepreneur with Jim Fruchterman of Benetech.
And of course, we're applying that same idea to other fields that need that same kind of tech disruption, not to make billions, but to make the lives of millions of people better.
Welcome to the Social Entrepreneur Podcast. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former business executive with Fortune 500 companies. Today, I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week, we bring you exciting stories from the world of social entrepreneurs, benefit corporations, and impact investing. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to episode 102 of Social Entrepreneur with Jim Fruchterman of Benetech. Now, Jim became a social entrepreneur 27 years ago. Now, at the time, there really wasn't such a thing as a social entrepreneur. He just knew that there was technology available and that there were needs in the world, and that if he could find a way to put those two together in a business model that would be sustainable, he could make a big impact. And so Jim really started with this idea about optical character recognition and how it could be used to give access to books to blind people. And since that time, he and his company have developed all kinds of solutions around the environment, around social justice and human rights. So it's a great story. You know, one of the interesting pieces is that Jim was one of the founding board members of the Social Enterprise Alliance, and he was even their chairman for a period of time. So this is a person who understands social entrepreneurship. I'm really excited to have him here. Here he is, Jim Fruchterman of Benetech.
Hi, I'm Jim Fruchterman, and I'm founder and CEO at Benetech. And we're Silicon Valley's nonprofit tech company that empowers communities in need with scalable tech solutions. So our approaches are the same as Silicon Valley's, but we're targeting the poor, the disadvantaged, and the nonprofit organizations that serve those communities, as opposed to focusing on making a maximum amount of dollars.
Right. But you're not allergic to making dollars.
No, I mean, our dream is that, you know, to get more of our projects to break even from revenue so that, you know, we don't need to keep going to donors to keep them going.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the projects that you've done then?
So we've done a whole bunch of different projects, but they tend to be in the areas of education, especially literacy for people with disabilities, human rights, and the environment. Those are our three focus areas. And we're trying to do more in the area of poverty is a new area for us. So Bookshare, largest library for blind and dyslexic people in the United States, serving 400,000 people with over 400,000 ebooks that we can turn into Braille or large print or computer voice so you can listen to it. We write strong crypto software for the human rights movement. They're using it to document human rights violations or back up confidential information like the membership lists of gay organizations in Africa. And then we've also written the main project management package in the environmental area. And then we have a labs effort that is basically talking to several different nonprofits every week about what their ideas about what Silicon Valley could do for them if Silicon Valley could afford to care about their problem.
Mm. That's a great, that's a quotable quote right there. Yeah. If Silicon Valley could afford to care. I mean, you know, I've heard you tell a few stories and, you know, one thing that I do recognize about you is that you really empathize. I mean, venture capitalists are looking to make a return. You know, it's not as if you are against that, yeah. but not every problem fits that model then.
Yeah. And our team is made up of pretty much people coming out of Silicon Valley, people like me who are entrepreneurs or corporate leaders who want to give back, who want to use the same skills that we've developed in business, which is great, but to tackle those kind of problems that business can't tackle when the market is going to fail to go there.
Right. So, Jim, how did you end up doing this? What's your path?
So I'm a geek. I'm an engineer. I love technology. I love solving problems. I love figuring things out. And so, quite logically, I went to Caltech, which is, you know, sort of geek mecca, and got a couple degrees there. And, you know, my focus, I was probably going to try to win, you know, a Nobel Prize in physics or become an astronaut was probably my objective. I came to Stanford to start a PhD program, but that didn't go according to plan. I started an entrepreneurship talk series at the graduate engineering dorm, and the second speaker was starting a private rocket company. And it was during a period where that was just becoming possible. So I dropped out of my PhD program, took a leave of absence, joined the rocket company, the rocket. I was the chief electrical engineer and did radios and telemetry and data. And the rocket blew up on the launch pad. And I came back and had to decide whether I was going to restart my PhD efforts or become an entrepreneur. And being an entrepreneur was just a lot more attractive. I'd been bitten by the bug of what a startup could do, something as crazy as starting, you know, a private launch vehicle company. And so I tried to start my own rocket company, but no one gave us $200 million to get going. And then my former boss on the rocket company came to me and said, hey, I've got an idea. I have a friend who wants to start a company. He's a chip designer. Let's get together. So we actually got together and I said, well, what's the idea? And they said, well, we want to make essentially a chip that can read anything. And I got really excited because I said, hey, when I was at Caltech, when I was basically, you know, taking classes, I came up with an idea of making a reading machine for the blind. And this is like my one good idea from college has just reappeared, you know, in this restaurant as we're talking about a new company. So that's how my entrepreneurial career really got going. We raised over $25 million in multiple rounds. We set out to build some technology that could, you know, read anything on a printed page, and we were successful. That technology is still around at a large public company as, you know, one of the leading products for scanning documents. And so the business was successful. But while I was there, the idea of using that technology for something that was not as, you know, business focused as writing software for insurance companies or, you know, the IRS, it was to help blind people. That idea was still in my mind. And so we built a prototype of a reading machine for the blind with a first generation voice synthesizer, and we demonstrated it to our board of directors. And at the time I was the VP of marketing, so I actually got to do the demonstration. It scanned a page. Our secret sauce would turn the picture of the page into a text file, and then we ran the text file through a first generation voice synthesizer, you know, that went, you know, these are the times that Trayman solves, but probably not quite that natural sounding. And our board said, great, Jim, you're the VP of marketing. The demo worked. What's the market for this product? And I said, well, we think it's about $1 million per year. This was not popular with our investors. And as a matter of fact, they vetoed the project in that meeting. They said, no, we can't afford the distraction to go off and work on a product that's only going to generate $1 million a year. We've put in $25 million in this company because we thought you were going to become, you know, a multi-hundred million dollar company. So don't work on this. And that's why Benetech got started.
You had the idea for this reading machine for the blind. What year was that?
Well, we probably demonstrated that in 1986 or 87, so almost 30 years ago. I left the company in 1989, and as part of my severance agreement in exchange for not competing with them or hiring away a bunch of their engineers, I got the right to start a nonprofit company that would make reading machines for the blind based on their technology. And I secured a similar deal from Hewlett-Packard for scanners and another key technology company for a more natural-sounding voice synthesizer. And that's how we started what is now called a social enterprise at the time. We just thought, hey, this is such a non-interesting market for Silicon Valley. My attorney suggested that we set it up as a charity, and we did. And so, and it turned out that within a couple of years, we were $5 million a year and profitable, which wasn't supposed to happen. But, of course, profitable is, you know, in the eye of the beholder. I mean, we probably netted 1% over a 10-year period, which is, you know, barely above break even. And our investors still would have considered it a flop. I mean, it didn't matter whether it was $1 million or $5 million. It was not going to score in what they needed to see in terms of a Silicon Valley company. But in the nonprofit sector, that turned out to be really successful. So I think one of the things that puzzles people is how Benetech actually generates money. What funds our operations. And about 85% of our budget is covered by revenues, basically people paying us for our services that range from individual nonprofits. In some cases, it's national nonprofits or government agencies that are buying our services. But I think, like a lot of social entrepreneurs, we are always aiming for how can we get this to break even from revenues, and that's a target for general just about all of our projects, except for where it's not a practical target. For example, in global human rights, if our target user is a human rights group in the human rights group in the developing world, they don't really have any money, and all the money in that field comes from donors. So our sustainability model there is that what it costs us to operate our human rights program should at least 90% be coming from human rights donors. But then the last 15%, that's grants from individuals, foundation grants, some government grants or corporate grants. And often this is what's funding the startup of new social enterprises at Benetech, because we have a real active effort to start the next couple of social enterprises. And so when we haven't really figured out what the enterprise is, we need some risk capital from donors to actually create it before it starts generating revenue. And that's our kind of our balancing act.
So I understand you had a little bit of a run-in with the IRS about the fact that you are a nonprofit, but you generated profit.
Yeah. So soon after we went into business of making the reading machines, another company went into, basically they talked to us and they basically copied our product. So, okay, it happens. Then they complained to the IRS that we were unfairly competing with them. So we had a full-scale IRS audit about 2 years in to the creation of the organization. And social enterprises were unusual, and one that made a profit was also quite unusual. And my remark to the agent, which was, hey, what good is a tax exemption, on profits if you don't someday have profits to not pay taxes on? I don't think he was amused by that. but the long story was, they did a full scale audit, and they basically said, hey, you guys are clean. We're not doing anything that you shouldn't do. You're doing exactly what you said you were doing in your application for nonprofit status. And so then they said the onus is on you to justify why the IRS granted you nonprofit status in the first place. And so we worked up with the help of one of our friendly attorneys, an argument on why being close to break even was not it was clear that we weren't being operated to be profitable, to throw off a lot of profits. All of us were working for less than we could be making in Silicon Valley. And they cited some cases of other nonprofits like low-income housing projects that ran a slight surplus and then set the surplus aside for, replacing the air conditioners in 10 years. So anyway, the audit was finally closed and our nonprofit status was confirmed.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that set a precedence and gave some air cover to a lot of other companies that were coming along after that.
Not as much as you might think, because because it was a private action. We didn't have to fight the IRS in court. It was, but I certainly did talk to quite a number of other people who had done things like this as years went by. And so informally we were something, but it wasn't something you could look up, for example, in tables of precedent.
Yeah. Now you were there at the founding, I believe, of the Social Enterprise Alliance. Is that right?
I was at the meeting where they decided to create what was then called the National Gathering of Social Entrepreneurs that evolved with a name change into the SCA, Social Enterprise Alliance. Yep.
Yeah, what was that like?
So, for me, the story was I didn't know why I was a social entrepreneur for the first 10 years. Right, I just thought I was the one crazy guy in Silicon Valley not trying to become a billionaire, and I was told that I was a crazy guy for not trying to become a billionaire, especially when the .com bubble was busy inflating and people were saying, Jim, you could make billions selling dog food over the internet. And I'm like, I don't want to sell dog food over the internet. So. Anyway, I ran into, people kept telling me that I should go up and talk to this guy in San Francisco named Jed Emerson. And I said, what does Jed do? Oh, he helps homeless people. I was like, why would I go talk to someone who helps homeless people? And but, you know, the fourth time someone suggested, I said, sure. So I went up and I talked to Jed, and he said, Jim, you're a social entrepreneur. There have been Harvard Business School, you know, Harvard Business Review articles written about social entrepreneurship. And a national meeting of social entrepreneurs is happening in Miami in a couple months, and you should go and meet some other folks. So I took Jed's advice, and it was mind-blowing. I mean, here are a whole bunch of people who could talk about social impact and business in the same sentence, and their heads didn't explode. And they were not engineers or high-tech entrepreneurs. They were social workers, and they were lawyers, and you know, they were activists, but they were far more like me than my fellow entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley by that time, because I was, you know, really about doing social good, and so were they, and we all believed in business. So they had a side meeting saying who might want to organize an association, and I was so enthusiastic about this that I volunteered to be on the founding board. And so and then I, you know, I ended up being on that board for 10 years and eventually becoming the chair of the Social Enterprise Alliance, and you know, I presided over the merger that helped create, you know, what became SEA. So it was an exciting, you know, time to get involved with the movement and start thinking beyond just my organization or its one, at that time, social enterprise.
And you've been doing this for more than 27 years.
That's right. So we started our nonprofit in 1989.
What do you think when you were launching this company, Benetech, what was the hardest part about getting going?
Well, I mean, for one thing, I thought I would only do it for a short period of time because I thought I would end up, you know, sticking with the for-profit world. I remember telling my wife I'd do it for a year. So one of the hardest things was actually, you know, it's kind of like a tar pit, right? It's very hard once you're in, and you know, it's very hard to get out. And so that was hard. I think the funny thing is that the business parts were pretty straightforward to me, right? I mean, we had this product, blind people wanted to read. It helped them read independently. It was, you know, our price point was competitive. It was actually, you know, to me, it looked like a business, but a business that wasn't going to get venture capitalists excited. And so actually getting the project going wasn't that hard. You know, like a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, we ended up with some early pivots. You know, my original idea was that we were going to distribute the reading machines with the help of volunteers all over the country. You know, basically technical people like me who would be excited about, you know, helping a blind person use this technology. But when I went around and started talking to initial users, I got a lot of information about that there was a better way. And they basically said, look, there's a whole bunch of smart, capable blind people who won't get hired by the companies that make equipment for the blind, or a whole group had just gotten laid off as part of a merger. And basically people said, you should hire members of the community to market your product as independent dealers. And, you know, the light bulb went off in my mind because the PC industry had just gone through, you know, that transition to independent dealers at that, you know, a couple of years before. And I went, oh, yeah, this is the same pattern. We can't afford to have direct salespeople or necessarily volunteers, but we can distribute it through the community and actually help people set up their own successful businesses. And that's what we ended up doing. So the majority of our distributors/dealers, they were people with disabilities, or a couple where one of the members or both of the members had a disability, and they made our product successful in that community. So it went very well.
What do you think has been your highlight? I mean, was there a moment where you looked around and you go, "This is so cool"?
You know, a lot of this is the. There's sort of like two major moments, right? There's the light bulb moment, which of course is never a single light bulb moment, right? It's an evolution, but there is a moment where you feel like I'm really getting that there's an opportunity here that we should do it, right? Whether it's starting the original reading machine for the blind business, or the idea of Bookshare with the library for the blind and dyslexic that we operate that came about because I encountered Napster early in its days. I mean, it's that moment where you go, oh, this technology can be used for that. And that happens to me a lot. And that's the most fun thing as a geek is you're taking your technology expertise and you see a problem and you go, I think I know how to solve it. And so like that's one of those sort of key moments. And then and the other key moment is when you realize that you actually are solving it, you know, that you've gone to scale and that you're making a difference and that the field no longer operates the way it used to, that you've actually changed the equilibrium to use the, you know, the Skoll foundation term, where, you know, the world was here and, you know, and it was not just enough, you know, for us who care about this issue. And now, you know, we're at this new and better equilibrium. And of course, then, you know, then you think, what's the next thing we're going to do to disrupt things and make them better? And so, and that's kind of, you know, the path that we've taken, right? We've, you know, first, the status quo when we started was blind people were read to, you know, either in person or by people sending around audio cassette tapes, right? That was the way it was done. And then we introduced the ability for blind people to scan their own books and read themselves without needing a sighted person to help. And then, and so now a lot more books were available to blind people because they had the tool in their hands where they could do it. And then the next thing we did is we reinvented the library for the blind dyslexic and said, if any blind or dyslexic person or parent or teacher has scanned this book, now nobody else has to do it because it'll all be available online as a service, you know? And so now, you know, pretty much if a blind person hears about a book that they need for school or work or someone recommends it, the odds that it's in Bookshare already and they could be reading it in 60 seconds are, I don't know, 80, 90, 95%. So we've actually like solved that problem. And then we're going to go to the next stage, which we're going to work on the publishing industry to make sure that standard ebooks work great for disabled people, which they still don't, unfortunately. But we're trying to convince them to do that. And then the need for us to be a specialized library or a toolmaker will recede because, you know, disabled people will just go and buy the same book on their iPad or their Kindle or whatever phone they have as everybody else does. And so, and that's, so, you know, we're ambitious not only to make the change once, but, you know, we're trying to make it happen multiple times. And of course, we're applying that same idea to other fields that need that same kind of tech disruption, not to make billions, but to make the lives of millions of people better.
You know, you've mentioned something twice now that I just want to highlight a little bit, which is pattern matching. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned, oh, that's how the PC companies have shifted. And then you mentioned, oh, I saw Napster was able to do this, you know, peer-to-peer sharing stuff. So I matched that. So how do you think about pattern matching? What's its role and When is it great? When is it not great?
So actually, my whole career is about two kinds of pattern matching, right? One is literally making machines able to recognize patterns, which is, you know, what optical character recognition is about. And right now, you know, one of the big technologies in Silicon Valley is machine learning, right? It's, you know, it's what Google is doing and the, you know, driverless car and all that kind of stuff. So not only is it something that where I'm thrilled with the technology, but it's also where it's our job to recognize opportunities to match technology up with needs, right? And so, and that's actually, I think, one of our key values to society is being the unlikely connector between communities that don't often connect, right? Silicon Valley isn't often thinking about the challenges of people with disabilities or you know, sexual violence victims in sub-Saharan Africa. It's just, it's not on their list. And so we're all the time getting these needs expressed to us because we are the Silicon Valley company that can afford to care. We'll talk to them, whereas a lot of these companies have to sort of like put up a wall so that no one will distract their people from making a lot of money. And but we're willing to actually have those conversations. And then we have like a time machine for social good technology. Right? Because if you look at the social sector, if you look at people who are impoverished or otherwise disadvantaged, the odds that the technology that they're using is 5, 10, or 15 years out of date is quite high. I mean, in the libraries for the blind and dyslexic, I think that one of our big competitors is still shipping audio cassette tapes through the postal service in 2016, right? Now, they've been phasing it out for a while, but I mean, that's how far these technologies hang over. So when I'm in Silicon Valley and I hear about a cool technology and it's been figured out in, let's say, the last 1 to 3 or 4 years, and people have kind of broken the code on what it can do and how it works and what it's good for and what it's not good for, I can then make the connection. So, you know, whether it was optical character recognition, pattern matching, not only helping route the mail and scan tax forms, but also, helping blind people read, or Napster, a peer-to-peer model, you know, coming up with a new way to create a library for the blind, put the blind and people in charge of creating the library instead of professional librarians deciding what they should read. And the ebook, okay, that's the other technology breakthrough that we used. Cryptography, this is how we helped the human rights movement. We started encrypting human rights data more than a dozen years ago. Now, Snowden has shown why that's so important, but we saw that 12 years ago. And it wasn't because we were that brilliant. We were on the trailing edge 12 years ago of knowing how to use that technology. It's just compared to the technology penetration into the nonprofit sector, we always look like we're way ahead of the time because we're borrowing from the people at the leading edge. And the technologies, I mean, today, massive application of machine learning, the blockchain technology that's behind Bitcoin, big data for social impact. I mean, we're busy connecting those dots now as kind of the people who are multilingual. We speak tech, we speak business, we speak activists, we speak, you know, policymaker, and we're trying to make those connections where those connections aren't being made today.
Let's, because of time, we're going to have to head towards closing here. So advice for early stage social entrepreneurs, what's one or two things you've learned on your journey that you wouldn't mind passing along?
Well, I think the first thing is I counsel a lot of, you know, startup social entrepreneurs, and I get asked, you know, a lot of the same questions, you know, where do we find the money and should be a for-profit or nonprofit, and try to give them help. But I think that one of the biggest issues is really understand the need of the people that you want to serve. In other words, just like if I was a for-profit company, I would be getting in deep into the mind of my customer to understand whether or not what I was coming up with was actually going to create value for them. The same thing goes when you're doing in social good. You know, you may not know best for a disabled person, for example. I see lots of ideas that are not well informed by the actual lived experience of the people that the social entrepreneur wants to solve. So first thing is customer and user focus. You know, make sure that the community that you want to serve actually wants you helping them with what you want to help them with. And I think the second thing is really about building a team, right? And every entrepreneur, every successful organization, you know, made it because of the people who came together. And that's often runs counter to the hero worshiping, you know, narrative in the social entrepreneurship field that it's about the solo social entrepreneur. But it almost never is about just that social entrepreneur, right? Yeah. It's the team that they pulled together. It's the people who talked them out of really dumb ideas or told them why they needed to change things. And so I think that that's also another thing that translates from business entrepreneurship into social entrepreneurship is, you know, a great team will help you accomplish, you know, great things, and don't think you can do it without them.
Great pieces of advice. If people were looking for your company online or on social media, where would they look?
So quite straightforward tags. I mean, obviously, Benetech is my organization, short for Beneficial Technology. So it's, you know, just BENETECH.org. I have a blog called the Beneblog. That is also easy to track down. And my Twitter handle is at Jim Fruchterman. Benetech's Twitter handle is at Benetech.
So, call to action. What's one thing you would love for listeners of Social Entrepreneur to go and do as a result of this conversation?
I think I would tell people to think about absence. It's often easy to see a problem and identify that you're going to work on it, but it's harder to see the thing that you're not seeing. And especially as, and I'm going to say on the average, social entrepreneurs tend to be more privileged people than the people they're trying to serve. Though often we have some fabulous social entrepreneurs who come straight out of the community that want to serve. But in general, you know, the things that we take for granted, you know, physical safety, health, educational opportunities. You know, many of these technology innovations that affect, you know, medicine and all this. Think about the people who aren't getting those. And the amazing thing about so much of what we've created in business over the last couple of decades is that they're intangible. Their ideas, their technology, their software, their new drugs, they're things that you know, when the cost of actually making them is a very small part of their value. And that makes it possible to take it to the world. And so many businesses stop at the first, you know, the richest 1% or 5%, because they figure those aren't interesting markets. But yet, almost all of those great things could be brought to the rest of the world. And I see that as the huge gap that goes beyond just, you know, making sure that people who are hungry are fed and people who are homeless have houses. But there's so many other benefits that we have that should be shared. And the barrier is far lower than I think people realize. So I just would just say, go out there and think about what's missing from this equation, rather than sort of just treating the symptoms of social ills.
Oh. Well, Jim, thanks so much for being with us on Social Entrepreneur.
Glad I could do it, Tony.
And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we produce Social Entrepreneur every Monday. Be sure to join us next Monday, where our guest will be Krista Carroll of Latitude. What's interesting is Latitude is a for-profit company, so they take a completely different approach than the nonprofit approach, and yet they are doing social good. So be sure to join us for that. It's a really good interview. If you'd like the show notes for today, you could head over to tonyloyd.com/102. That's TONYLOYD with one L, tonyloyd.com/102. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining us today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.